Good afternoon, and welcome to the meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations for July of 2014, coming to you today from Point Lookout on the Midcoast of Maine, and a particularly warm welcome to our radio audience. My name is Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1983, we're in our 31st year. The forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of the Foreign Service or academia, international businessmen, or journalists talk about critical foreign policy issues facing the United States and answer questions from our members and guests, many of whom are experts in their own right. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website, midcoastforum.org. Today, we're delighted to have as our speaker John Mearsheimer, professor of political science and co-director of the Program on International Security Policy at the University of Chicago. He graduated from West Point in 1970, served 5 years as an officer in the U.S. Air Force, and received his doctorate, his PhD, in political science from Cornell in 1980. He has written extensively about security issues in international politics. His most recent book, Why Leaders Lie, The Truth About Lying in International Politics, came out in 2011. His best-known book, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which he co-authored with Steve Walt in 2007, made the New York Times bestseller list and has been translated into 21 different languages. He has written a number of op-ed pieces for the New York Times and other papers dealing with such diverse topics as Bosnia, nuclear proliferation, American policy towards India, the failure of Arab-Israeli peace efforts, and the folly of invading Iraq. Today, his subject is the follies of American foreign policy. So let's give a warm welcome to John Mearsheimer.
Thank you very much for the kind invitation, Mac. And I'd also like to thank Pat Mundy, who invited me and made all the arrangements for my wonderful visit. And of course, would like to thank all of you for coming out today to hear me speak. The subject, as Mac said, is the follies of American foreign policy. And what I'd like to do is start off by describing what I think the foreign policy is that we have pursued since 1989, talk a little bit about the end result of pursuing this policy, and then raise some questions about whether or not it makes sense. I believe that the policy we've pursued since 1989 is best described as global domination. And this policy of global domination is predicated on a set of very simple beliefs. The first of which is that every area of the world is a core strategic interest for the United States. What happens in every nook and cranny of the globe matters to us, and we have to pay a lot of attention to it. So we are not in the business of prioritizing. We're in the business of treating every area as if it's equal to every other area. Second belief, which is very important, is that we live in very dangerous times, that the United States is a remarkably insecure country. There are threats everywhere. And this is reflected in General Dempsey's comments that this is the most dangerous period in his entire lifetime. This is a man, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who was born in 1953. So his lifetime goes back pretty far. It includes some of the dark days of the Cold War. But nevertheless, the general and many others think that it's more dangerous today than it was when the Soviet Union was alive and kicking. The third belief is that we have the ability to fix these problems. Yes, we do live in a dangerous threat environment, but the United States is very rich, very resourceful, very clever, very cunning, however you want to put it, and we can deal with these problems. The fourth belief is that military utility, the American military has great utility for dealing with these problems. We have a big stick, and we can use that big stick to solve these problems. And when you marry the belief in the United States that liberal democracy is on the march, that we defeated fascism in the first half of the 20th century, we defeated communism in the second half of the 20th century, and really there is no alternative political ideology. And what's going to happen over time, as Francis Fukuyama made clear in his very famous article, The End of History, is that the world is going to democratize. It's going to look more and more like us. And since we're basically the good guys, if everybody looks like us, you're going to have a planet that's filled with good guys, and you're not going to have any trouble. And this is why Fukuyama argued that you're going to have the end of history. Now, it's very important to understand that we believe that you can use military force to speed up that process. We believe it's reasonably easy to spread liberal democracy. And once you spread liberal democracy, you have the magic formula for peace. So those are the, I think, the basic beliefs that underpin global domination. Now, what's been the end result of this policy? First of all, the United States has been at war for 2 out of every 3 years since 1989. We have fought 6 separate wars. The war in Afghanistan, which is ongoing, is the longest war in our history. And the truth is, we've not done very well at fighting these wars. As you know, we lost in Iraq. Anybody who has any doubts about that just has to pick up the newspaper every day, and you can see how wildly unsuccessful we were there. And of course, we're going to lose in Afghanistan too. And we have, of course, sensed that and understand full well that when we get out, everything will go to hell in a handbasket there, just as it went to hell in a handbasket in Iraq. And of course, we're still talking about using military force in other contingencies, so this hasn't ended. If we don't get a nuclear deal with Iran and we suspect that Iran is going down the nuclear road, we have said we'll use military force against them. There's all sorts of pressure on President Obama to use military force against Syria. You all remember what happened in August of 2013 when Syria was said to have used chemical weapons, how much pressure was brought to bear on him to bomb Syria. So I think it's fair to say one result of this policy is that we have become addicted to war. Second, we have a huge defense budget. It's truly amazing how much money we spend on defense. Used to be, it's not quite true anymore, that we spent as much money on defense as every other country in the world put together. Also, we have spent an enormous amount of money fighting the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's hard to get a firm number on how much money will be spent in the end on those two conflicts, but the estimates are somewhere between $5 and $6 trillion for those wars. And as you watch Iraq disintegrate and you watch the Iraqi army fall apart, you want to remember that we spent $25 billion training that army. This is really quite amazing, because where I come from in Chicago, and I think it's true all over the country, we could put that money to good use in terms of our schools, in terms of our infrastructure. Most of you probably understand that when you fly out of most American airports and you go to Asia, and even to Europe, you're flying out of third world airports like LaGuardia and LAX to first world airports in Asia and Europe. And then, of course, there are the human costs. 6,700 plus Americans have died in these wars. Well over 50,000 people have been wounded. Now, of course, this does not affect most Americans because we have this very small military that is willing, for reasons I can't fathom, to go and fight these wars that most Americans would otherwise not fight. All the public opinion polling shows that most Americans think these wars are not worth fighting. And if we had a draft and they had to draft your grandchildren or children, you can rest assured we would not be fighting these wars. So the human costs for most of us, not very great, but there is a small slice of the population that's paying a great price to fight wars that we lose. And then finally, what we are creating in the United States, we've always had something of it, is a national security state, a state that threatens civil liberties. As anybody who's studied civil-military relations or the history of liberal democracy understands, and our founding fathers certainly understood this, you cannot have a large and powerful national security state and be fighting wars all the time and maintain a liberal society at home. And it's no accident that the NSA is spying on all of us, that we're engaged in torture here, there, and everywhere, that we have Guantanamo, where due process is being violated in ways that run against American principles. And because we don't want to put anybody else at Guantanamo, we now run around the world killing people instead of capturing them and putting them at Guantanamo. No new people are being put at Guantanamo. We prefer to kill them with drones. This is sort of what America's become. And if you go around the world and you get behind closed doors and talk to people about American exceptionalism, they think you're delusional, and it's for good reason. So if you want to fight wars 2 out of every 3 years and spend all that money on defense and dominate the world, you want to understand that there's a price to pay for it. Nothing's for free in this world. And I've tried to sort of describe that. Now, this raises two big questions. First of all, is this necessary? And second, is this policy workable? In other words, can we just make some adjustments and make it work? Maybe it is necessary. Maybe it is necessary. And maybe we can make it work. Now, what I want to argue is that it's not necessary. And we can't make this policy work. It's doomed to fail. Now, let's talk about the necessity. As I said to you before, most people in the foreign policy establishment believe that the United States lives in really dangerous times and that the threat environment out there is really scary. In my opinion, this is pure poppycock. The United States is the most secure great power in the history of the world, and it is more secure today than it has ever been in its entire history. The idea that we live in a high threat environment is laughable. Let me illustrate this to you by talking a little bit about isolationism. Most of you are old enough to know about isolationism and what happened in the late 30s and early 1940s. In the early 1940s, when Hitler was on the march in Europe and Imperial Japan was on the march in Asia, Franklin D. Roosevelt went to great lengths to defeat the isolationists and try to get us involved one way or another in World War II. He was deathly afraid that Hitler would establish hegemony in Europe and that Imperial Japan would do the same thing in Asia. He was unsuccessful up until Pearl Harbor. He could not break the back of the isolationist movement in this country absent Pearl Harbor. Now, many people think the isolationists were lunatics, they were crazy, America was deranged at the time. I think the isolationists were wrong, and I'm glad that Roosevelt was able to beat them via Pearl Harbor. But the isolationists had a remarkably powerful case to make, which is why Roosevelt couldn't beat them. And their argument was that for geographical reasons, i.e. the fact that we're separated from Europe and Asia by two giant moats, meant that nobody could get at us. The only area of the world that mattered to us in terms of strategic considerations, the only area of the world that we should fight and die for, said the isolationist, is the Western Hemisphere. It doesn't matter whether Hitler conquers Europe, and it doesn't matter whether Imperial Japan conquers Asia. That was the basic isolationist argument, and it's a very powerful argument. Fast forward to today. As all of you know, those two giant moats are still there, number one. Number two, we now have thousands of nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are known as the ultimate deterrent. You do not invade countries that have nuclear weapons, because the one scenario under which they will be used is if a country's survival is threatened. And number three, we live, according to virtually all my friends, in a unipolar world. That means, by definition, there's one great power in the international system, us. We have no great power rivals. In the late 30s, early 40s, when Roosevelt couldn't break the back of the isolationists, Hitler was out there with the Wehrmacht in his hand, and Imperial Japan was on the march in Asia. There were mighty great powers out there, and we still felt secure enough that most Americans didn't think we had to fight in Europe or in Asia. Today, we have no rival great powers. It's a unipolar world. And again, we have thousands of nuclear weapons. And again, we have the Atlantic Ocean and the Pacific Ocean. What's the threat? Oh, I know, you worry about the underwear bomber? And if it's not the underwear bomber, it's the shoe bomber, right? There's no question that the terrorist, Al-Qaeda, got a shot in on us on September 11th. But think about what's happened since then. Think about how serious the terrorist threat is. It's just not that great. Is it a problem? Yes, it's a problem. But this is not the equivalent of the Soviet Union. This is not the equivalent of Nazi Germany. It doesn't even come close. You understand that one of the reasons that we're pursuing this foolish grand strategy, one of the reasons that we're running around the world doing all these foolish things, is because it has no significant strategic consequences. It's because we're so incredibly secure. We're so incredibly safe that we can go out and do all sorts of stupid things and it doesn't matter. Now, another dimension to this is that there are areas of the world that matter to the United States. I'm not an isolationist and I'm not making the case for isolationism. I'm just trying to tell you how powerful the case for isolationism is today and how powerful it was in the late 30s and early 40s. But I'm not an isolationist. There are areas of the world that matter. Three of them, in fact. One is Europe, two is Northeast Asia, and three is the Persian Gulf. Not the Middle East, the Persian Gulf. Europe and Northeast Asia matter because that's where the other great powers are historically located. And we do not want any one great power in either one of those regions to dominate the region the way we dominate the Western Hemisphere. We do not want Imperial Germany or Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union or Imperial Japan and China down the road to be a regional hegemon the way we are a regional hegemon in the Western Hemisphere. So Europe matters, Northeast Asia matters, and of course the Gulf matters because of oil. And we want to make sure that no one country, either in the region or outside of the region, controls all that oil. So those are our three core interests. But otherwise, the rest of the world doesn't matter very much. I was in the American military from 1965 to 1975, which is coterminous with the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was a giant blunder. We had nothing at stake strategically in Vietnam. As you all remember, we lost that war. It was a decisive defeat, and it didn't matter one iota. 14 years later, we won the Cold War. Right? We should have never been fighting that war in Vietnam. Right? It's not a core strategic interest. Same thing is true with Africa. We have no vital strategic interest in Africa. We have no vital strategic interest in the greater Middle East. Syria, Egypt, it doesn't matter. So what if ISIS wins and creates a caliphate or a state? What do you think they're going to do to you? Just ask yourself that question. What do you think they're going to do? Create an armada and sail across the Atlantic Ocean and invade Long Island? Please. Think they're going to get on an airplane and fly into the United States? Will they be a minor irritant? Yeah. But you know something? If you get out of their face, they probably won't bother with you. You ever think about that? You ever wonder why these people are targeting us? Right? It's because we're targeting them. You've got to back off. The point I'm trying to make to you is this is a remarkably secure country. You should be very thankful for yourself, you should be very thankful for your children, and you should be very thankful for your grandchildren that you live in the United States of America. And again, this is not to say there aren't areas of the world that we should care about. There are. But they're few in number, and we can deal with them reasonably easily. Now, what about the question of whether we can make this policy work? Let's just assume that I'm wrong, and it's a really dangerous world. And we have to do something, and therefore we have to try and figure out if we can make this work. And maybe we've just been going about it the wrong way. I'm sorry, you can't succeed pursuing this policy, right? And the reason you can't succeed pursuing this policy is because the policy is all about social engineering, right? When the United States gets in the business of running the world, it's basically saying that it can go into different countries and it can do social engineering. Just read the newspaper every day. We're deciding who should be running Iraq. We're deciding who should be running Ukraine. We're deciding what kind of political system they should have. Remember all these color revolutions, the orange revolution in Ukraine, the red, was it the red revolution in, or pink revolution in Georgia, I forget. I can't keep track of them all. This is the United States, the National Endowment of Democracies, running around the world telling people what kind of political system that they should have. And it's social engineering. Social engineering is an incredibly complicated task. Just think about the problems we have here in the United States. We can't even fix our own problems. Do you really believe that we can go into a place like Iraq or Afghanistan and you can put people like us in charge who don't even speak the language, know nothing about the culture, and we can do meaningful social engineering? Please. This is going to fail every time. And let me get to the real reason that it's going to fail. The real reason is that the most powerful political ideology on the planet is not democracy. It's nationalism, right? Nationalism. And nationalism is all about self-determination. What nationalism means is that people who live in countries like Vietnam, people who live in countries like Afghanistan, don't want Europeans or Americans coming into their country and telling them how to do business. They want self-determination. They want to run things for themselves. This is the problem that we got into in Vietnam. We argued in the establishment that Vietnam was all about communism. It was not all about communism. It was all about nationalism. The Vietnamese did not want first the French running their country. Then they did not want us running their country. They wanted us out. They wanted a unified Vietnam, and they wanted to determine their own future. Self-determination. So you have this wonderful military, the US military, that is fully capable of going into almost any country in the world and toppling the regime. This is what we did in Iraq. We could do it in Syria. We could do it in Iran. But the problem is, toppling regimes then leads to you, the United States of America, owning the place and having to figure out how to make it work politically. You're back to social engineering. This is what happened in Iraq. The boys and girls who made the decision to go into Iraq thought that we could go in, topple Saddam, democracy would sprout forth, we would get out and move on to the next target. That's what the Bush Doctrine was all about. They thought we had successfully done that in Afghanistan between October and December of 2001. Remember how quickly we defeated the Taliban? And then we installed Karzai in power in Kabul, and then we got out. We thought that was the end of it. Wrong. As I told you before, the longest war in American history is the war in Afghanistan. It didn't work. You think it worked in Iraq? No, it didn't. We're still trying to figure out, via social engineering, who to put in control in that country. What's the lesson here? Stay out, right? And of course, what's amazing is, in 1991, when we drove the Iraqis out of Kuwait, we did not go to Baghdad because we understood full well that if we went to Baghdad, we owned the place, and if we owned the place, we were in the deep kimchi. But something happened between 1991 and 2003 to convince us otherwise, and we were wrong. So the point that I'm making to you is that our chances of succeeding are not very great. This is not to say we can never succeed. We succeeded brilliantly in the first Gulf War in 1991 because we had a rather different mission. It was not social engineering. It was simply to drive the Iraqis out of Kuwait. And you put the American military up against the Iraqi military in the desert, and this is Bambi versus Godzilla. And we drove them out, and we were smart enough not to go to Baghdad. But anytime you start talking about going into countries like Afghanistan, you remember what happened to the Soviets in Afghanistan. You remember what happened a long, long time ago to the British in Afghanistan. Vietnam, the French told us in 1965, do not go in there. De Gaulle warned us, been there, done that, does not turn out well. We went in. And then you remember what happened in 1979. The Chinese were foolish enough to go in and pick a fight with the Vietnamese. And they got their snouts whacked. Not a good idea, right? You want to be very, very cautious about invading countries and ending up in a situation where you occupy them. But here we have this policy of global domination that's all about running the world. Right? And of course, you have people like Madeleine Albright who tells you that we're the indispensable nation, that we stand taller, we see further. Really? What in our record in recent years gives anyone cause to think that we stand taller, we see further, that we're the indispensable nation, that we're an exceptional nation? I'd say we are exceptional, exceptionally incompetent. Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Ukraine, the Israel-Palestine conflict, John Kerry's done a brilliant job solving that one. Iran, that's an ongoing problem. Hopefully they'll pull a rabbit out of a hat on that one, but you wouldn't want to bet a lot of money on it. We could go on and on. American foreign policy, it's the Midas touch in reverse. It's really quite remarkable. But again, this is all unnecessary. The idea that there are all these threats out there that we have to worry about is simply wrong. You live in the most secure country in the history of the world. There are some threats, but they are small-scale threats, and they can be dealt with smart policies, certainly not through global domination. And again, you want to remember that global domination helps create these problems, because when you go around the world beating up on people, these are your adversaries, you go around the world beating up at them, you should expect them to try and retaliate. That's what happened on September 11th. Let me conclude by saying a few words about what I think is to be done. I think, and this should be evidence from everything I've said up to now, that we should abandon our strategy of global domination and adopt a policy of restraint. And this is just another way of saying we should go to great lengths to curb our interventionist instincts. More specifically, what this means is that we should focus only on our core strategic interests. We ought to get back into the business of prioritizing. And areas of the world that don't matter to us strategically, we should pay little attention to. Furthermore, with regard to those areas of the world that matter to us, we should even try to reduce our footprint there. I would be in favor of removing virtually all American troops from Europe. I would reduce our footprint in the Persian Gulf. And I think Asia is a very different matter because of the rise of China. But I think the United States should go to great lengths just to focus on the areas that really matter strategically, and even there reduce the footprint as much as possible. We also want to pay much more attention to the limits of military force. There's great respect for the American military as an institution, and there are some things that the American military is very good at doing. I don't want to denigrate the American military in any way, having spent 10 years of my life in the American military. But the idea that you can use the American military to do social engineering is a prescription for disaster. And I think we ought to recognize that and operate accordingly. I also think we should significantly limit defense spending. I think the United States spends much too much money on defense, and curbing the defense budget would be a good idea. This raises the question, what is the likelihood that we will adopt a policy of restraint in the future? Now, one might think that the likelihood is very great, in large part because the record of failure is so obvious. I think this logic applies to how the public, the wider public, thinks about American foreign policy. All the poll data shows that most Americans want to cut back on our interventionist policies. Most Americans, I think, understand we are remarkably secure. Zbigniew Brzezinski recently gave an interview in Germany where he was lamenting the fact that most Americans don't know much about foreign policy and don't seem to care much about foreign policy. And he, I think, finds this quite surprising. I don't find it surprising at all. The reason that most Americans don't care about American foreign policy is because, as I told you, the United States is a remarkably secure country and they don't have much reason to care. You care about foreign policy when you live next door to a gorilla and there's a threat that that gorilla will attack you. We do not live next door to gorillas. We have the Canadians to the north, the Mexicans to the south, and fish to our east and west. We have thousands of nuclear weapons and we are the Unipol. In that world, you don't have to worry much about threats. And that's why most Americans don't care about foreign policy. But to the extent that they do care, most Americans, here I'm talking again about the public, are interested in significantly limiting our interventionist tendencies. But the problem that we face is that the foreign policy establishment in this country, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats, are deeply committed to global domination. When you deal with the Republicans and the Democrats, you're basically dealing with Tweedledee and Tweedledum. There's no meaningful difference between the two parties. You know, many people like to blame the neoconservatives for the war in Iraq. And there's no question that the neoconservatives were in the vanguard. But you want to understand that liberal Democrats, I like to call them liberal imperialists, were fully in favor of that war. You understand that Barack Obama opposed the Iraq war, but he has not had, at any point in his two administrations, a single senior foreign policy advisor who opposed the Iraq war. Think about that. Barack Obama has not had a single foreign policy advisor in either of his two administrations who opposed the Iraq war. And he's had people like Hillary Clinton, who is every bit as hawkish as any neoconservative on the planet. So the idea that, oh, if we only get the Democrats in, or if we only get the Republicans in, things will be better. No, you have a consensus within the foreign policy establishment for an interventionist foreign policy. And therefore, the question becomes, who's going to win in this battle between the public on one hand and the foreign policy establishment on the other? My view is that the winners will be the foreign policy establishment, and that will be due to the fact that the public doesn't pay a really great price for what's going on. We have this very small military that's willing to fight here, there, and everywhere. And most Americans, therefore, don't have to fight these wars. And most Americans don't believe the price, the economic price, is that great. And as a consequence, there's just not going to be a lot of pressure from below on the foreign policy establishment to curb its worst instincts. There'll be some, for sure. I don't want to be naive about this. There's no question that given what happened in Iraq and what is happening in Afghanistan, that we'll be much more reluctant to do another one of these wars. But nevertheless, you do not want to underestimate how powerful the inclination still is in the foreign policy establishment. Again, among not only neoconservatives, but the liberal imperialists who advise Barack Obama to use military force anytime they see a threat on the horizon. So I am sad to say that I remain pessimistic about the future of American foreign policy. Thank you.
That was... Well, it was not optimistic, but it was certainly interesting, and I think there are an enormous number of people here who agree with you. At least there are at my table. We'll start with a question about China. You sort of referred to China very briefly. Looking down the road, you say now it's not a threat. How big a threat to our security do you think China is, from a military strategic point of view, but also from a cyber warfare point of view?
I believe that if China continues to grow economically at an impressive pace over the next 20 to 30 years, that we will face an adversary like we have never seen before. China has roughly four plus times the population of the United States. And if it were to turn into a giant Taiwan or a giant Hong Kong or a giant South Korea, it would have easily two or three times the wealth of the United States. And as you all know, the two principal building blocks of military power are population size and wealth. To give you some sense of just how big a problem this will be, the Soviet Union at its height probably had about the same size population as the United States, and it had at the very most about one-third the wealth of the United States. And you know how much trouble they gave us. We're talking about a country that's going to have two or three times the wealth and four times the population, and we're going to be taking them on in East Asia, in their backyard, 6,000 miles from the California coast. This is not going to be pretty, right? Not going to be pretty. Now, the question you have to ask yourself is, what is China likely to do as it gets wealthier? My view is that what China is going to do is it's going to try and dominate Asia the way we dominate the Western Hemisphere. They're going to try and push us out first beyond the first island chain, beyond the first island chain, then beyond the second island chain, and they're going to try and get us as far away as possible. They're going to try and be the most powerful state in the region and dominate their neighbors. It's not to say they're going to conquer them, but they're going to basically write the rules on how you behave in the region, right? And they would be very smart to do that. If I'm Chinese, I want the Americans out of Asia, and I want to run Asia. You all understand that that's the way we think. You all understand that we have the Monroe Doctrine. The Monroe Doctrine says that the Western Hemisphere is ours. No great power from Europe or Asia is allowed to come into the Western Hemisphere. That's what the Monroe Doctrine says. Well, my mother taught me when I was a little boy, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If we have a Monroe Doctrine, why shouldn't they have a Monroe Doctrine? Right? They're going to have a Monroe Doctrine. And by the way, the Japanese had a Monroe Doctrine of their own in the late 1930s when they tried to dominate Asia. Right? You all know that the United States is going to go to great lengths to prevent China from dominating Asia. This is what the pivot to Asia is all about. Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton can try and say it's not about containing China, but you go to Beijing, the Chinese laugh at Obama and Clinton for saying this. They understand full well what the pivot's all about. It's all about containment. You can see the balancing coalition going into place already. I can tell you what the countries are. Go home and Google Japan and India, strategic relationship. You'll be shocked at how much strategic cooperation there has been between Japan and India, despite the geographical distance between them, in large part because they're both scared of China. So we, the United States, and China's neighbors are going to form a balancing coalition and try and contain China. And China's going to try to dominate Asia, as it should. And the end result is we're going to have an intense security competition. It'll look a lot like the Cold War in some ways. So my view is that if China continues to rise economically, right, the United States is not going to be in a particularly benign threat environment like it is today.
Do you want to comment on the cyber security problem with China as a threat?
I'll skip on that, okay, just because it would take me 10 minutes to unpack it.
All right. Well here's a related question about China. Do you think China has a better foreign policy today? It's a more pragmatic one than the United States has.
I think the answer is yes and no to that. I think that the Chinese, because they do not have anywhere near as much power as the United States, are much more disciplined. When you have an adversary or a set of adversaries or a set of threats out there that are serious that you have to deal with, you tend to be much more prudent, much more rational in your behavior. Remember what I said about the United States. I believe that one of the reasons that the United States runs around the world pursuing this foolish foreign policy is in large part because the strategic costs are not very great. For China, which has to live with the United States on its doorstep, which lives next door to Japan, lives next door to Russia, lives next door to India, has a series of border disputes and territorial disputes involving islands in the East China Sea and the South China Sea. They have to prioritize and they have to think very smartly. So I think in that sense, they have been smarter than us, okay? On the other hand, I think the Chinese have not been particularly smart in terms of their foreign policy as of late, because it's in their interest to keep quiet and to lie low now, and to continue to grow and grow and become more and more powerful, and then become assertive when they're really powerful. They're not that powerful now, and therefore they should not be terribly assertive. But they have been quite assertive and quite provocative in recent years. And what they're doing is they're playing into the hands of the United States, because it's making it easier for us to put together a balancing coalition. Deng Xiaoping said many, many years ago that the smart policy for China is to keep quiet and not try to assume leadership in the international system, but instead to just grow economically. And they were doing that very well for a while, I would argue up until 2008. But after 2008, they began to say things and do things that scared their neighbors. And in my opinion, is counterproductive. And the most recent example of that, by the way, is putting this giant oil rig right off the coast of Vietnam, which has provoked the Vietnamese and scared all sorts of other people in the region. It was just unnecessary. Their smart strategy is to just grow and grow, and then when they're so powerful, lay down the rules.
Okay, we've got a couple of more specific strategic questions. Where do North Korea and Iran fall in your, quote, countries to worry about because of their nuclear capabilities? Should we be doing anything about them because of their potential, you know, in the case of Iran or North Korea's current nuclear capabilities?
With regard to North Korea and Iran, both of them are in regions that I said were of core strategic interest to the United States. Korea is in Northeast Asia, and Iran is in the Persian Gulf, and in fact, Iran is one of the major oil-producing states in the region. So it's not just the nuclear weapons issue that makes them important. What also makes them important is that they're in core strategic areas. With regard to North Korea, North Korea is not going to get rid of its nuclear weapons, in my opinion. And in my opinion, they would be crazy to get rid of their nuclear weapons. In my opinion, the two countries on the planet that have the worst geography are Poland and Korea. Korea is located between China, Japan, and Russia. It's no accident that Korea has disappeared from the map on numerous occasions. Poland is located between Germany, Soviet Union / Russia, and Austria, which used to be a powerful country. And it's no accident that it's disappeared from the map on numerous occasions. If you're North Korea, and you live next door to those three countries, it's really nice to have nuclear weapons, because nobody fools around with you when you have nuclear weapons. To switch over to Iran, I do not believe that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons at this point in time, but I agree with Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, who said the best reason to think that Iran is pursuing nuclear weapons is that it makes so much sense from their point of view, right? Because they are nuclear weapons the ultimate deterrent. And given that the United States and the Israelis are threatening Iran, it makes sense to get nuclear weapons. You understand, if Iran had nuclear weapons, the Israelis and the Americans would not be threatening it. Right? It would just take the threat right off the table. So it makes very good sense for Iran and North Korea both to have nuclear weapons. And North Korea has them, and I don't think North Korea will get rid of them. And by the way, when you go to South Korea and you talk to people behind closed doors, and South Koreans start thinking about unification, one thing they like is the fact that they'll inherit those nuclear weapons. You all know that in the Cold War, South Korea and Taiwan tried to develop their own nuclear weapons, and we landed on them both occasions like a ton of bricks. But they understood, not surprisingly, that nuclear weapons are the ultimate deterrent, okay? So we're doomed on North Korea, because I don't think there's any way to get rid of those weapons. But that really complicates matters for us in Asia. And the real problem is it gives the Japanese very powerful incentives of their own to get nuclear weapons, and we don't want Japan to have nuclear weapons. With regard to Iran, it is in our interest to make sure Iran does not have nuclear weapons. I'm fully in favor of doing that. I think a deal could be cut. It would not be a perfect deal, but I think a deal could be cut where they don't have nuclear weapons, but they have enough nuclear infrastructure that if they want to get those weapons, they could do it reasonably quickly. That's the deal that can work out. I don't think we're going to get the deal. And I think if we don't get the deal and we continue to threaten them, they are going to end up with nuclear weapons, and that's not going to be in our interest.
Okay, how about another hot spot? What do you see in the short and mid-range future for the current stage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Yeah,
and what should be our role?
Yeah, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, there's all this talk about a two-state solution. I believe a two-state solution is a smart outcome, certainly for the United States, and I believe it's a smart outcome for Israel, and I believe it's a smart outcome for the Palestinians. I believe that there's not going to be a two-state solution, and I believe that Netanyahu has made that unequivocally clear in recent pronouncements. I had no doubt 2 or 3 years ago, not going to be a two-state solution. You're going to get a greater Israel. You already have a greater Israel. Israel will control all the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean. It will include Gaza and it will include the West Bank. You will have, I believe you already have, I could walk you through the numbers, but you certainly will, in short order, have more Palestinians than Israeli Jews inside of greater Israel. And those Palestinians will continue to resist. The idea that they're going to beat the stuffing out of Hamas, and Hamas is going to roll over, and all the Palestinians are going to roll over, and the Israelis are going to live happily ever after, is not going to happen. The Palestinians are going to continue to resist. And Israel is going to create, certainly in the West Bank, if it hasn't already, an apartheid state. And the apartheid rhetoric is being used all the time, and it's causing the Israelis huge problems in terms of its legitimacy worldwide. And that situation will only get worse with time. I think that from an American point of view, there's nothing we can do. Israel's supporters in this country will not allow us to put pressure on Israel to get it to create or allow it to create a, allow us to help create a viable Palestinian state. It's just not going to happen. So I think that the whole Kerry mission over the past year was a complete waste of time. And I was actually shocked that he was foolish enough to try and push forward a two-state solution, because there's just no chance that that's going to happen. And again, I think a two-state solution is in Israel's interest. I think if the United States could get tough with Israel and force Israel to give up the settlements and create Palestinian state, it would definitely be in Israel's interest. But it's not going to happen, because we cannot put any pressure on the Israeli government, because Israel's supporters in this country just will not allow that to happen. So this is going to continue to fester, and I don't know what the long-term consequences are, but I find it hard to believe that Israel is going to be able to maintain itself over the course of this century as an apartheid state.
Okay, we're going to switch to Russia. How do you think Obama should be dealing with Russia's President Putin as it relates to the situation in Ukraine? And is his behavior, is Putin's behavior a threat to us or Europe?
I have very iconoclastic views on Ukraine. And I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times for anybody who wants to look at my views in a bit more detail than I'm going to present here. And I'm also, I've done a big piece that will be coming out in Foreign Affairs on Ukraine. But the conventional wisdom on Ukraine is that Putin is interested in creating a greater Russia. Putin is deeply depressed by the fact that the Soviet Union disappeared, and what he wants to do is recreate something that looks like the Soviet Union. And he saw the crisis this past February involving President Yanukovych's disposal as an opportunity to take Ukraine and then even start thinking about taking eastern Ukraine, to take Crimea, then to start thinking about taking eastern Ukraine and possibly all of Ukraine. And the whole idea is that we have to beef up NATO because there's a threat from Russia to maybe even take the Baltic states back. So he's very dangerous. And he, of course, created the crisis. And we're just reacting. And what we're trying to do is deter him from further aggressive behavior. I think this is simply wrong. I believe that the West created the crisis, mainly the United States. And my story goes like this. Our goal for a number of years now has been to expand NATO eastward, expand the EU eastward, and foster an orange revolution inside of Ukraine. And this is all done for the purpose of making Ukraine part of the West. What the United States and the West Europeans are interested in doing is pulling Ukraine out of Russia's orbit and making it part of the West. The Russians have made it unequivocally clear since the mid-1990s that they are opposed to NATO expansion. They couldn't do anything to prevent the first two waves of NATO expansion, 1999, Poland, Hungary, Czech Republic, 2004, when the Baltic states, Romania, Slovenia, Slovakia came in, couldn't stop that. In 2008, in April 2008, we said at the NATO summit in Bucharest that Ukraine and Georgia were going to become part of NATO. The Russians said that is not going to happen. And basically what's going on here is Vladimir Putin has said that I will wreck Ukraine before I will let it become part of the West. I will wreck it. That's what's going on. He took Crimea, and he is in the process of trying to wreck Ukraine, because Ukraine is foolishly trying to join the West. And the United States and the Europeans are foolishly trying to peel Ukraine away from Russia. Many people say Putin has no right to do this. The Ukrainians have a right to join the West if they want. I think right and wrong has no meaning when you're talking about great power politics. And why Americans don't understand that befuddles me. Go back to the Monroe Doctrine. You know, we have a Monroe Doctrine that says great powers are not allowed in the Western Hemisphere. Distant great powers are not allowed in the Western Hemisphere. You all remember the Cuban Missile Crisis? You remember the problems we had with Cuba during the Cold War? You all understand that Fidel Castro has been in power since 1959, and we still have our gun sights on him. We still have an embargo on Cuba. Why? Because he dared to violate the Monroe Doctrine. He dared to invite the Soviets into the Western Hemisphere. This is simply unacceptable. We would not tolerate an adversary on our doorstep. Well, why should Putin not be able to think the same way about Ukraine? Putin shouldn't mind the fact that a former military alliance that was a bitter adversary of the Soviet Union is marching up to Russia's doorstep? Please. The Russians, not only Putin, the entire Russian foreign policy establishment has made it clear that NATO expansion is unacceptable to include Ukraine and Georgia. It's just unacceptable. I told you, we announced that Ukraine and Georgia were going to become part of NATO in April 2008 at the Bucharest NATO summit. You all remember in August 2008, there was the Georgia-Russia war? Go back and Google the Russia-Georgia war. It was all about this issue. It's all about this issue. The Russians were not going to let Georgia become part of NATO, and they're not going to let Ukraine become part of NATO. So we're leading the Ukrainians down the primrose path. And he has the levers to wreck the place. He's got the leverage, he's got the economic leverage. Ukraine is a basket case to begin with, and it gets a huge amount of its natural gas from Russia. He can jack up the prices, he can demand payments for past deliveries, and so forth and so on. So my view on Ukraine is that Putin is not the problem, right? It's the West that is the problem. I just want to say one final thing on this. We need Putin, right? We need Putin and the Russians on Iran. The Russians are cooperating with us on sanctions against Iran. You all remember who pulled Barack Obama's chestnuts out of the fire on Syria last August 2013? The Russians. We need the Russians to help us get the troops out of Afghanistan. And by the way, we're going to need the Russians against China. But what are we doing? We're driving the Russians and the Chinese together when we're going to need the Russians in the balancing coalition against China. And for those of you who think that Russia's some great threat down the road, the country's depopulating. Remember what I told you before, the two principal building blocks of military power are population size and wealth. It's shrinking population-wise. It's in demographic decline. This country is not a rising great power. This is not China. The idea that it's going to become the Soviet Union again is not going to happen. And by the way, one final point, I could go on and on about this. If you really want to screw the Russians, hope they invade Ukraine. It'd be like swallowing a porcupine. Remember what happened when the Soviets went into Afghanistan? Remember what happened when we went into Afghanistan? Remember what happened when we went into Vietnam? Remember what happened when we went into Iraq? Remember what happened when the Israelis went into Lebanon in 82? We go on and on. You think they're going to easily conquer Ukraine? They're not going to easily conquer Ukraine. Even in the Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine, all the public opinion polls show that an overwhelming majority of people do not want to become part of Russia. They want to remain part of Ukraine. So you're going to send that rickety old Russian army into Ukraine and try to swallow it? Good luck.
Do you think it's possible that Obama and his foreign policy advisors are Machiavellian enough that they're trying to encourage Putin to get into the Ukraine?
Well, that would be a Machiavellian strategy, but it would be a foolish strategy because, again, we need the Russians. The Russians are not a problem, right? NATO expansion was a bad idea from the beginning. And by the way, George Kennan said in 1999, he was interviewed by Tom Friedman of the New York Times. You can find this online. Kennan said what's going to happen here. He was an adamant opponent of NATO expansion. He said, we're going to expand NATO. It's going to create a big crisis. And then we're going to blame the Russians. Because, of course, you know the United States because it stands taller and it sees further and it's the indispensable nation. And because of American exceptionalism, we never cause any of these problems. It's always the bad guys.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to cut it here because we've already gone way over it. But we've got a whole bunch of questions that are going to remain unasked and unanswered. But let me reward you with the very famous Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations mug, which I'm sure you've heard about.
Thank you very much.
It was terrific. I mean, it was great. It was great. I wish there were some cause for optimism with what you said, but I guess it'll all play out over time. Thanks an awful lot.
Thank you very much.